As we approach the close of the year of mercy promulgated by Pope Francis, it seems fitting to speak about God, in whom mercy and justice abide inseparably. Specifically, then, we will examine together what the human creature owes God. Should the thought of owing God anything strike you as unfamiliar, consider that each Sunday at Mass we acknowledge him as the maker of heaven and earth, of all things visible and invisible. Who would think that such a great benefaction does not require something of the beneficiary? Even when someone has never recited the Creed at Mass, it requires effort to maintain the illusion of one's complete autonomy. What follows then aims to relieve people of the burden of escaping God. It proposes a way to help people to abide in a proper relationship with God, the maker of heaven and earth. This discussion enjoys an importance unlike any other, for without one's maintaining a proper relationship with God, the human person, not God, suffers. And so the Church teaches solemnly, without its creator, the creature simply disappears. If God is ignored, the creature itself is impoverished. Tonight's discussion concerns the virtue of religion. It is easy to think of religion only in sociological terms, as if religion represents an impersonal component of the cultural landscape. Religion offers something that one joins, for example. As a virtue of the heart, however, religion entails more than an optional exercise of free association. The virtue of religion gives definition to specific internal and external actions. The principal religious acts, moreover, are the internal ones, which take on concrete forms such as devotion and prayer. Like all virtuous actions that we undertake, the performance of the acts of religion shape a person's character. Religion directly affects the perfection of human existence, and one needs more than sociology to fathom its depths. Those who recognize that religion marks a person's character can still harbor misconceptions about how this virtue works. For example, sometimes people make a distinction between being religious and being spiritual. Generally, the distinction means that though a person embraces no specific form of religious practice, he or she remains sensitive to more than simply the material dimensions of life. Although a commonly made assertion, that is, I'm a spiritual person but not religious, this distinction unfortunately fails to persuade. It doesn't make sense. In short, spiritual cannot serve as a cipher for a completely disembodied form of religious observance. Spiritual cannot describe whatsoever interior dispositions of soul that masquerade as authentic religious practices. The term spiritual points to something else in the human person than covert affections for some higher power, even if we name such God. Because the human person possesses an immaterial soul, each member of the species can claim being at least partly spiritual. The human person, created in the image of God, affirms the Catechism of the Catholic Church, is a being at once corporeal and spiritual. The spiritual in the human person signifies something real and constitutive of what it means to be human. To quote the Catechism's straightforward teaching, soul signifies the spiritual principle in man. Although one finds metaphorical uses of spiritual that point toward religious activities, such as St. Ignatius's The Spiritual Exercises, or African-American church songs known as spirituals, the fact remains that the term religious signifies another feature of human perfection than that the rational creature possesses a human soul. Thus, as the title of this lecture suggests, we proceed on the assumption that the human person, each one of you, and everybody else, necessarily exhibits both spiritual and religious dimensions. One is spiritual insofar as one possesses a human soul. One is religious because no creature in heaven or on earth can step away from the relationship to God that creation establishes. Or one can rebel against it, as did Satan. No one, however, can destroy it. Even suicide, to take a sad example, leaves the God and creature relationship intact. All in all, atheism is easier to define than to practice. To sum up, all on planet Earth possess both spiritual and religious traits. One question remains open. How should a person act in order to perfect these qualities of being human? The virtue of religion finds its place in the hierarchy of moral virtues among those virtues attached to justice. We describe cardinal virtues, such as justice, as hinge virtues, that is, a virtue on which other related virtues, so to speak, hang. The Latin word for hinge is cardo, cardinal. Justice-type virtues regulate the several kinds of debts that human beings incur among themselves and in relation to those who stand above them. Some people wrongly think that religion matters only to people of faith. Only believers, they opine, bother about religion. And to be sure, the Catholic faith teaches a great deal about religion and its obligations. However, religion exists as a natural virtue. No human person can flourish without practicing religion. The hypothetical non-religious person would have to discover another cause for his or her existence. For this reason, although religion binds us to God, it falls among the moral, not the theological virtues. Religion governs right human conduct toward God, whereas the theological virtues of faith, hope, and charity ennoble this conduct in ways only known from divine revelation and actualized through the free gift of grace. Since, especially after original sin, folks tend to make mistakes about the exercise of religion, natural religion is not a good situation in which to remain. A person may easily fall into superstition, idolatry, divination, and the sin of tempting God. Still, divine revelation is not required for the human person to recognize that God, the unfailing principle of human existence, is due the debt of honor. Now, I recognize that since the 18th century, at least, Western intellectual life has thrown up challenges to both God and the virtue that binds the human person to him. These objections range from the prejudices of Enlightenment figures such as Diderot, to the minimalist demands of 18th century thinkers who argued for only as much revealed religion as reason allows. Think of Thomas Jefferson. I also know about the putative scientific claims that contemporary authors such as Richard Dawkins advance and would seem to eliminate the hypothesis, as the proponents would have it, that God exists and that he is the maker of heaven and earth. The new atheism movement, as it's called, still rallies its followers. However, experience shows that the purveyors of agnostic and practically atheistic opinions draw more publicity than they win true, lasting adherence. Theologians respond that only God, the one first being, which simply is, in the fullest sense of the term, can account for why something is rather than is not. In short, empirical science, even the most sophisticated, claims no purchase on accounting for what simply is, or, as the Latin teachers say, being simpliciter, that is, without qualification. One should not waste much time, then, on fashionable academic airs that pretend to do away with God. Truth to tell, however, our present circumstances seem shaped neither by Enlightenment agnosticism nor 20th century pretentious scientific claims. Contemporary neglect of religion mainly stems, in my view, from nations. People simply do not know that they owe God honor. We find ourselves encountering a good example of a natural law obligation that suffers eclipse because of defective environments and misleading instruction. These are the kinds of circumstances that even 13th century theologians recognized as capable of diverting people away from the observance of natural law practices. At the same time, no amount of cultural deformation is able to eliminate altogether those inclinations in which natural law expresses itself. No one can shake off religion altogether. When I was a young priest back in the 70s, or ordained in the 70s, the big movement was called secularity. We had courses on secularity. Everyone said, watch out, you know, the world is becoming secular. Harvey Cox at Harvard, the secular city, was, everybody read it, it was the Bible. That turned out to be, you know, not so lasting an opinion. I mean, and as you can see from the nightly news, the fights, of course, are all centered around religion. The challenge that faces practicing Catholics today consists in their announcing to people that no one should remain confused about God. No one should stay in the dark about what the human creature owes the maker of heaven and earth. Put it briefly, people need to realize that they enjoy borrowed existence. No one can take credit for his or her own actualization. This may seem like a heady approach to win back fallen away Catholics, or what is increasingly the case, to reach out to people who have never been catechized, perhaps not even baptized. Some may opine, wouldn't it be easier to point out the attractiveness of Christian community? Others may wish to emphasize that God is required to ensure ethical conduct among men and women. Still others may try to capture the emotions of the person who is not church-going by appeal to sentiment, music, or even, God forbid, corporate ecstatic behavior. While one may allow for a certain pragmatism when it comes to religious conversion, that is, whatever works is good, I prefer to think that argument best persuades the rational creature. For example, one way to lead into the religious question with people who have never entertained it or who have been misled by false arguments involves asking a question. The question arises from the subtitle of tonight's lecture, Why We Owe God an Hour a Week. To explain why we do entails a discussion of the acts of religion. One gains an advantage by introducing the religiously misguided person directly into the practice of religion. Why do we owe God an hour a week? The answer requires few words. Because he made us. All must reserve time each week to render God his due. The Church provides for our fulfilling this obligation. I refer to the Sunday Mass celebrated on the altars of Catholic churches throughout the world. To make the leap to the altars of the world, let's start with another question. When was the last time that you offered God sacrifice? Recall that at each Mass, the participants hear the priest exhort them in these words, pray that my sacrifice and yours may be acceptable to God, the Almighty Father. Still, the question may startle even some faithful Catholics. It can easily happen that the everyday Mass goer may not take this invitation at face value. What may one think of these words of priestly exhortation? How do people likely interpret an acceptable sacrifice? Today's educated Catholics, for the most part, will receive the language of sacrifice as figurative or symbolic. The priest, they assume, invites them to form an internal disposition to refrain from selfishness. Others simply pass over the ritual prayer without their pondering what it means to ask God to accept there in the priest's sacrifice. Still others may think that the priest refers to the collection taken up after the homily. These and similar reactions to the word sacrifice, a term which appears in both the official liturgical text as well as much classical Christian piety, leaves Catholics bereft of a full understanding of what it means to practice religion. Sacrifice is not an option for the spiritual and religious person. St. Thomas Aquinas even taught that sacrifice falls under the natural law. If we follow his lead, then one can make philosophical arguments for offering sacrifice, what theologians call apologetics, arguments that persuade people to accept certain conclusions that pertain to religious faith. Since such arguments in principle can appeal to any human creature with the use of reason, they are used as a way of leading folks to see that revealed religion does not require its adherents to abandon their capacity for sound reasoning. Again, Aquinas holds the view that the requirement for man to offer God sacrifice can be known by natural reason. In other words, the truth that God rightly claims sacrifice from his creatures does not depend only on Christian faith. Catholics are not the only ones who require the holy sacrifice of the Mass. That's the basis for evangelization. How does Aquinas lay the foundation for the bold assertion that offering sacrifice to God obliges everyone? He proceeds in three movements. First, according to Aquinas, the human creature cannot avoid its own fragility, its defects, at least death. Therefore, all persons recognize the need for help from a superior being whom they commonly, Aquinas says, refer to as God. Second, Aquinas considers that each human creature discovers, by a dictate of natural reason, the need to render submission and honor to those above his or her status. Further, the human person depends on sensible signs in order to express internal dispositions. And for these reasons, the rational creature owes God sacrifice, both as a sign of subjection to him and as a way of honoring him. In another question of the Summa Theologiae, Aquinas spells out what is unique about offering sacrifice. He says, quote, "Since external reverent actions are signs of internal reverence, certain external signs of reverence, such as adoration, are shown to more perfect creatures." He has in mind the biblical texts that report that Abraham adored angels and that Nathan the prophet bent down before David the king. Aquinas smooths over these biblical expressions, and then he adds, however, there is one external sign of reverence, namely sacrifice, which is offered to God alone. What strikes clearly the wise person may not be so apparent to others. It may happen then that this kind of argumentation does not capture the attention of many people who need to hear about God. In this case, one can turn to divine revelation that embodies the same truth. Remember to keep holy the Lord's Day. However, given the general atmosphere of incredulity, that is, the neglect of revealed truth or the willful refusal to assent to it, even the third commandment may not make much of an impression. What is left then to the person who wishes to help another discover God, or perhaps for the person who himself flirts with incredulity? Well, one can simply go to church on Sunday, where he or she will hear the priest invite them to offer sacrifice. A friend in Boston who once served as a focus missionary helpfully explained to me that the missionaries place great importance on the power of the invitation. Many people, especially young people, find themselves so unfamiliar with the church and churchly things that they hesitate to draw close to them. They need help. Place yourself at Mass. Let's suppose that instead of rationalizing the invitation, those who hear the priest's invitation pray that my sacrifice take it at face value. In other words, they believe, or at least are drawn to believe, that what happens during the Mass constitutes a real sacrifice. Then comes the question, what in fact are we sacrificing? The answer may surprise some devout persons. Catholic teaching, however, supplies the authoritative answer. Christ himself. The answer expresses Catholic doctrine, no room for debate or further research. And each Mass, offered since the Last Supper, the Eucharistic sacrifice, reenacts, without repeating, the sacrifice that Christ makes on the cross. And this is how the Catechism of the Catholic Church puts it, relying on the Council of Trent, a 16th century ecumenical council, which formulated Catholic teaching on the sacraments in reply to Protestantism, which denied the whole kit and caboodle. The sacrifice of Christ and the sacrifice of the Eucharist are one single sacrifice. The victim is one and the same now offers through the ministry of priests who then offered himself on the cross. Only the manner of offering is different. And since in this divine sacrifice, which is celebrated in the Mass, the same Christ who offered himself once in a bloody manner on the altar of the cross is contained and offered in an unbloody manner, this sacrifice is truly propitiatory. Propitiatory means that Christ's sacrifice forgives our sins and the sins of the world. Remember what Aquinas said about the human creature recognizing his or her defects. Now, people may pretend that they are without guilt of sin, but for the most part, they know that they are pretending. Truth to tell, the world needs a propitiatory sacrifice. We find an argument for this claim in St. Anselm's Gradeus Homo. While one may not separate Christian satisfaction or propitiation from Christ's crucifixion, physical pain does not alone account for the universal efficacy of Christ's death. From the sacred scriptures and the liturgy, we learn that the love and obedience with which Christ underwent his bitter passion makes his bloody sacrifice acceptable and therefore propitiatory. It is not that difficult to start with religion as a natural moral virtue and with sacrifice as a natural law requirement directed only to God and to arrive at the need for the Holy Mass. There we encounter Christ's sacrifice, a mystery of faith that perfects variously the human existence of those who participate in this privileged form of adoration. So the answer for Catholics to the question, when did I last offer God sacrifice, is always the same, the last time that I worthily participated in the holy sacrifice of the Mass. The last time that I said, may the Lord accept the sacrifice at your hands for the praise and glory of his name, for our good, and the good of all his holy church. Why do we owe God an hour a week? If it were not the case that many different factors today militate against our rendering God what is his due, it would be easy to summarize a reasonable answer to this question. Such a reply would run something like this. Our position as creatures wholly dependent on God, not only for our coming into existence, but also for our being sustained in existence, places us in a relationship of an inferior to a superior. Inferiors owe superiors some measure of honor and submission. Moreover, we recognize our defects and the sins that we have committed. Our state of sinfulness requires some remedy. We need to acquit ourselves of these debts by the performance of sensible religious signs that are accomplished in coordination with a devout and prayerful spirit. The human creature would confront a predicament were he or she persuaded of owing something, but without knowing what is owed. Let's say a teacher announces that there are requirements for passing a course, but does not stipulate what the requirements are. So when the church around the world offers the sacrifice of the Mass, the well-advised person should be grateful to have found an authentic way to fulfill an obligation. It really does not matter whether such a person came to the conclusion that God is worth an hour by reasoned argument or by hearkening to the first commandment, I am the Lord your God, you shall not have strange gods before me, and to the third that follows upon it. Unfortunately, however, we live in an age where people have been tutored in the habit of becoming incredulous. So perhaps the best way to show people their need for religion and sacrifice begins by developing the art of extending an invitation to come to Mass. It goes without saying that the pedagogical value of the Mass increases to the extent that the liturgical celebrations are carried out in a worshipful manner. Reverence forms part of submission. Religion and reverence go together. Casual liturgies that give the impression that the Mass instantiates only a communitarian symbolic activity we'll leave the Masco with the thought that better community-based activities can be found elsewhere, for example, on sports fields. Flashy liturgies can communicate the view that one comes to Mass in order to satisfy oneself rather than to worship God. Sound preaching further contributes to priests helping people discover the true meaning of the Mass. It is self-defeating for priests to use the pulpit for any reason other than to announce that those present at Mass are involved in the highest exercise of the virtue of religion. So I urge you to think of the Mass as an indispensable part of your weekly routine. I suspect for all of you it is, but of course you have to be missionary. The Church celebrates the Mass daily. Attendance at Mass during the week bespeaks high devotion. All, however, hold God the minimum time during each week when, on the Lord's Day, the Church, through the ministry of priests, offers a sacrifice to the one who remains our infinitely superior and loving Father. People who do not go to Mass commit other sins. People who remain faithful to the Mass also may sin. Neither condition excuses someone from assisting at Mass. Those who are not disposed to receive Holy Communion should not do so. They should, however, still fulfill their obligation to worship God. Truth to tell, fidelity to the Mass remains the best way to prepare for the sacrament of penance and reconciliation. When people neglect observing the third commandment, it comes as no surprise that they will find it difficult to keep the seven commandments of the second tablet of the law. Catechism of the Catholic Church makes the point when it quotes Matthew 27. The second is like it. When someone asks him which commandment in the law is the greatest, Jesus replies, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the greatest and first commandment. And a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." Briefly put, the commandment to love God requires sacrifice. Because one cannot separate the two great commandments, it is also true that the commandment to love the neighbor as oneself requires our offering sacrifice to God. So I conclude with the exhortation to remain faithful to assisting at Sunday Mass. Go to Mass on the days of holy days of obligation, such as Christmas, the Immaculate Conception, and other feast days as indicated by the Church's pastors. Holy days provide a distinctively Christian dimension to the natural law requirement to keep holy the Lord's Day. We focus on the mysteries of our Lord and Our Lady and the saints. Sundays and holy days draw us into Christ's saving sacrifice, whether or not we receive Holy Communion. For those who do not attend Mass regularly, correct your practice and go to church each Sunday. Faithful Mass goers should invite those who may feel awkward about coming into a church. Everybody needs a way to fulfill the natural law obligation to offer sacrifice to God. Bear this requirement, however, in mind. In order for people who have never been to Mass or who are not baptized to enter fully into the sacramental life of the Church, they need to receive sound pastoral care from a cleric so as to prepare for whatever sacraments they may require: baptism for those never baptized, or penance for those who have been baptized. Other considerations may also come into play. Without a full participation in the sacraments of the Church, no one discovers what it means fully to be both spiritual and religious. We do, O God, an hour a week. The Catechism explains that God created everything for man, but man in turn was created to serve and love God and to offer all creation back to him. No other destiny befits the human creature composed of body and soul and heart. The English poet George Herbert recognized our plight and the need for sacrifice in The Altar, a poem published shortly after his death in 1633. Herbert gives both an example of pattern poetry and a sound insight. The words of the poem are so arranged to resemble an altar of sacrifice. An image that caught his 17th century Church of England admirers somewhat off guard. A broken altar, Lord, thy servant rears, made of a heart A broken altar, Lord, thy servant rears, made of a heart and cemented with tears, whose parts are as thy hand did frame, no workman's tool hath touched the same. A heart alone is such a stone, as nothing but the power thy power doth cut. Wherefore each part of my hard heart meets in this frame to praise thy name, that if I chance to hold my peace, these stones to praise thee may not cease. Oh, let thy blessed sacrifice be mine, and sanctify this altar to be thine. Thank you. So, Father Sebastian tells me there's time for questions. I'm happy to entertain questions or dialogue, as the case may be. However, at a certain point in time, he'll signal that it's over, and the people that want to leave can leave, and those that want to stay are welcome to stay or adjourn to the reception area. This reminds me of the famous Dominican who came to Dover once, and they advertised the lecturers, model families. Dover was a suburb of Boston that was fairly wealthy. As a matter of fact, we had a school there for a long time. And all of the suburban folks, husbands and wives, saw model families, and they thought, well, we're going to listen to him, and he's going to tell us how to raise our kids. And unfortunately, Father Ivo was a logician. He was an Englishman, he was a logician. He was talking about model logical families. After much longer than I took, after about an hour of talking about, you know, logic and model families and Venn diagrams and so forth, he stopped and he said, you know, are there any questions? And there was much the same response. I use this one. And finally, some lady raised her hand, and she said, Father Ivo, I haven't understood a word that you said. To which he responded, Madam, which word? Go ahead there. Great, thank you. The other two Dominicans are sitting there looking rather puzzled. I would have thought they'd helped an older brother. Go ahead.
Could you perhaps speak about the case of somebody who is not aware of the truth of divine revelation? What is the possibility, or what is the story for somebody who is sort of left only with the practice of natural law or natural religion?
Well, that the answer to that. So, Father White asks, the situation, you know, is natural religion efficacious?
Enough, right?
Yeah. And that's, you know, like predestination question. Okay. No one knows that, because that puts the person in a relationship with God that is not at all raised to what God himself has supplied. So that's why evangelization. But everybody knows that the church rejected Jansenism, the Massa Damnata. So everybody, you know, who's not a Catholic is not thereby condemned to hell. However, what isn't said enough, especially because of comparative religious studies, I mentioned it briefly, natural religion is a very precarious situation to be in. All you have to do, because people, the need to offer sacrifice has included, as the Old Testament makes clear, child sacrifice. The need to offer sacrifice has included on our own American continent, South America. You can see in Mexico City the artifacts, the sacrifice of children, of loved ones, and certainly of enemies. Enemies were routinely sacrificed. Their hearts ripped out, you know, live and pulsating in an effort to bring rain or to bring... So, you know, they're fine. You can read the Old Testament and you discover, you know, the bowels were not nice places to be. A lot of bad things happened there. We don't talk about them in polite company, but they weren't pretty. You know, they were mostly sexual perversions of one kind. You know, so in the old days they would say, well, Aristotle was the one that had a kind of perfect natural religion because it was purified. He had a view of God. Yeah, right up there. That's St. Paul, isn't it? Was that Aristotle together with St. Paul? Yeah, well, Aristotle did it, you know. He did it. He got it because he saw the one and he talked about religion and probably was a devout and prayerful man in his own way. That was the old, you know, people wouldn't say that today. You'd have 10,000, not 10,000, you'd have all the Aristotle scholars telling you that that's a Christian invention. But so the answer to your question is, A, we don't know, but we do know that sins against religion, like idolatry, sacred poles, idols, totems, you know, that those are sins ruled out by the first commandment. And that puts people then in a sort of more complicated question about natural religion.
You were talking about ancient sacrifice in the Old Testament, ancient sacrifice. So the Roman sacrifice, according to a model, dealt with debts. I give so that you might give back to me. Mm. So there's this model of reciprocity. Right? So how can we distinguish the Catholic sacrifice? Because, of course, we are not giving directly so that we may receive back. But what is the difference? What is the nuance in the Catholic sacrifice that distinguishes it from the ancient?
Well, the most important thing is the true God, opposed to false gods.
Of course, but I mean, in terms of the mechanism of the sacrifice, how is that working in a different way?
Well, do or des is a statement of intention. Mm-hmm. It is possible to apply that to Catholics. You know, any Catholic sacrifice, fine. At the Mass, when the priest says, "Pray, brother, my sacrifice," and the response that I read is, "May the Lord accept the sacrifice at your hands for the praise and glory of His name, for our good and the good of all His holy church." Well, that's due at death. We're praying to receive back good for ourselves, the perfection of practicing virtue, and we're praying that that good redound to the whole church. So now, due at death is a somewhat pejorative expression, but is there reciprocity? Yeah, of course there is reciprocity. But it's the reciprocity that arises from a creature and a creator. It's the reciprocity of someone who needs to receive from God every good thing. I mean, prayer is due, you know, we pray. So the main thing that separates the true sacrifice offered on the West, St. Augustine, this is the city of God. I mean, he's all about this. I mean, he said all those, they all, you know, they were in the right ballpark, but the wrong, whatever the image is. I mean, they didn't, you know, the wrong base or something. St. Augustine went through all the city of God has texts. And, you know, the bottom line is they said they were not sacrificing to the true God. And therefore, what, you know, it was idolatry. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Yes, Brother Humbert.
When I hear people describe themselves as spiritual but not religious, I get this idea that they have some desire to connect with the transcendent, but don't want this transcendent to make any demands on them or on their behavior. So what do you think is the key to harnessing this desire and to bringing it to a relationship of sacrifice for the true God?
Well, okay. Fine. Based on what I said, when spiritual mean, I mean, you know, you have to be careful. If spiritual, simply, spiritual cannot be used to express covert religious sentiment. It just can't be used. I mean, if you're going to say I'm spiritual, because it's a metaphorical use of spiritual. Okay, it's not even analogical. Okay, it's romantic. It's Victorian romantic poetry more than it is anything else. Like African spirituals. You know? Spirit. The reason spiritual evolves from spirit, well, spirit is a word for soul, but spiritual, the way that's used, so it can't be used, that's my, I said, fine. Spiritual can't be used to signify covert religious sentiments that are kept within the person and which are private and which have no external expression and are not regulated by the norms that govern religious practices. Now, if you want to say, well, it's better that somebody who walks in and says, I'm spiritual but not religious, is better than someone that comes in and says, I'm neither spiritual nor religious. I'll grant you that. I'll concede it without granting. I'll grant it without conceding, excuse me. I'll grant it without conceding it because I'm not so sure, to be honest with you. I almost think I'd rather deal with somebody who's flatly honest about their lack of anything than somebody who's cooked up an explanation for why they don't have to go to church. But let's say, so I'll grant you, however, and concede, without conceding, I'll grant you that, fine, you're going to, it's better to have someone who says I'm spiritual, not religious. Well, the first thing is I think, this is what I would do. Now, you might have other way, you know, how what works is good, pragmatism in the end, right? But what I would do is, sure, I would say, good, you're spiritual, well, you have a soul. Where did you get it? And if they tell you, oh, this is just a highly formed, you know, part of matter, everybody knows, you know, everybody knows, you know, mathematicians can create a soul, pray for Pythagoras, I mean, you can do all of that stuff, artificial intelligence, then you can tell them very easily, well, now you're not spiritual, you know, you're fully material. So, but that would be my lead in. Now,
so, using that way, then you're not getting the proper definition.
No.
Yeah,
it's a right. I think it's not even analogical. I think it's metaphorical. And it's a canard, basically. It should be. Yeah. Sure. Good.
You said inviting people to mass. A thing that I would something that I wonder is, so you have a friend who is Catholic, but they haven't been going to mass. You invite them to mass. How do you kindly explain to them that they shouldn't receive the Eucharist without making them feel as if you are judging, you are placing yourself in judgment of them?
Oh, that's a good question, and I did not answer that. I left out because then it would have gone on. I mean, that's another talk. Okay. Be honest with you. No, it's a good question. Well, okay, fine. There are two ways of doing it, okay? There's the direct way, and there's the indirect way. The direct way is to say, the Eucharist cannot be eaten unworthily. What does it eat the Eucharist unworthily mean? To eat the Eucharist unworthily means this. The Eucharist is a sacrament of charity and unity. It increases charity, and the charity unites us, okay? So you take focused missionaries. I mean, the Eucharist is a center of growth in charity and of union. And you're on particular, so that's the whole church. Now, if a person, but the Eucharist does not create charity. Nobody ever taught it, no St. Augustine's, no, nobody. It does not create charity, okay? It does not create. There are only two sacraments that create, so to speak, charity. One is baptism and the other is reconciliation. Now you might say, well, so the Eucharist is not, you know, the gold ring. This is an old example, but maybe you remember the old merry-go-round, you get the brass ring, you get another rind. Okay. Well, you know, the Eucharist is not the brass ring that the boy used to get it for the girl. That's probably sexist now, I shouldn't say it. But the boy, and you get another ride on the merry-go-round. That's not the Eucharist. So if the person isn't loving God or hasn't been loving God and hasn't been loving the neighbor big time, well then why do they want something which they think is going to increase when they can't increase? That's the direct way. It's the fundamental truth that's lost, by the way, on a great deal of today's discussion, that you can't be going north and south at the same time. And people kind of realize that without making it sound like you're impugning guilt to them. In other words, you have to talk about what the Eucharist is. It's not simply a symbolic meal that just everybody that takes it is included. It's not that. Never has been that. Jesus, I mean, you can read the Last Supper, you know, the whole thing. I mean, it's the sacrament of the body of Christ. It's the sacrament of his blood. I mean, it's the sacrament, you know. So the Eucharist, right, many, your generation, because of depreciated catechetics, a lot of people think that it's a symbolic act that, you know, it's like getting, you know, clinches the deal, but it isn't. So you wouldn't want, you know, to do something which is really a contradiction and which can't, it's only going to exacerbate your contradiction. You know, I mean, so fine, we'll take something, you know, on off the second tablet of the law, big thing. You know, if last night I murder somebody because I want his money or because I hate him or because I want to get rid of him as a political, to take a very current possibility, a political, yeah, well, I mean, read the newspapers. I tell the seminarians, there's no problem. Read the newspapers because all the examples come right off the front page of the New York Times without any difficulty. Well, if you kill somebody the night before, and the next morning the guy, you say to them, why don't you, so let's say it's your boyfriend, and you say, why don't you come to Mass? And he says, honey, I killed somebody last night. Yeah, well, they can come to Mass, but they can't receive communion because that's neither love or union. They just got rid of a union. And you can do the same, you certainly can do the same things with the big things like adultery. Or most, the biggest sin, the fact that they haven't been loving God, and since they owe it, this is not, you know, an optional, aren't I a good, I'll drop in. That's the whole point. I think you have the natural obligation. You're supposed to have been doing it all along. If you didn't, well, there's a sacrament for that. They go together. Well, that's the direct way. The indirect way is, first of all, sit in a part of the church where the ushers aren't going to come up and say, come on, come on, come on, you know. Well, it's true. Once I was at a convention way out, I forget, it was either Santa Fe or Albuquerque, I don't know where it was. But there was a cathedral there, and they said, well, you have to give a communion, sure. And I went down with the priest, and I'm standing there, and the front pew came up, the ushers came down, Come on. Two people came up with the most anguished look, a husband and wife on their face like this. They came up with an anguished look, and they said, we're not Catholic. It's a historical cathedral. We just came to see the building. We wanted to be here because of the building. I said, fine, you just go, you know, go away. So, I mean, in other words, you don't put the person in a, I mean, it's indirect, you know, or you find some clever way to say, ordinarily Catholics prepare, you know, you give them, sometimes at the cathedral, they put guidelines for receiving communion, you know, you put that in this thing, something like that. I mean, that's how, those are indirect ways. Or you just have that wonderful smile and you say, you know, dearie, you know, Jack or Jill, it's great you're here. See, that's why, I mean, I didn't have time to emphasize everything, but, you know, you have to start making the point that being present at the Mass is still a real participation in the worship of God. And if they're sinners in need of propitiation, well, yeah, except there's another sacrament for that. Jesus was smart. Yeah, but that's another talk, though. That's why we have to go to confession. But that's another talk. I can't fit that in. I fit a lot in here, but I can't fit that in. But he was smart because, you know, this represents the movement of divine grace taking hold of your will. Okay, does that help? Somebody else said. Yeah, good. Then the other.
So I have a question regarding some of the natural law stuff you talked about. Especially, you mentioned some of the Aquinas about, there's a thing throughout that human creatures cannot avoid their defects.
Right.
And so therefore, what do you say, what would you say to those who sort of, in a way, think that they can? You know, I mean, like, I think more and more, so I've had an experience with a friend in college who I talked to for a while, and after listening, she said something to me along the lines of, like, Will, about my faith, and she was saying, you know, Will, that's great for you, but I don't really think I'll ever come to a point in my life where I'll see a need for that until there's, like, utter calamity, basically, until I hit rock bottom. And I think more and more, in more subtle ways, that's a theme. What would you respond?
Well, is this a girl not going to church? She already hit rock.
So now someone not Catholic.
That doesn't make a difference. Does it mean did she...
Not going to church, not Catholic,
yeah. Well, she already hit rock bottom. I mean, that's not... She's already at rock bottom. Yeah, I mean, that's the whole point. I mean, okay, fine. How do you... You know, what the truth is and how you do it are two different. The pregnant, fine. Religion is not a crutch. You know, that's as much as, you know... And that's Marx, that's 19th century rationalism, that's Nietzsche, you know, fine. Schopenhauer, the only people who need religion are old women. You know, religion is not a crutch. And once, if that's what people have, see, this is the problem of too much, Archbishop Benoit calls it. Making religious too much a part of sentiment and the expression of sentiment. That's wrong. It's at the level of being. That's why you got to go to soul. You don't feel it. You don't see it. You go to soul. And soul isn't so difficult. Everybody in this room has, you know, could give, you know, ask, why are you not all the same? And you know you're not. Where does it come from? That spark of life that makes you so different. Even husbands and wives. You know? And husbands and wives, once they have your parents know, they begot children, they did a lot. But no parent has a reasonable expectation, whether they believe it or not, think that the child, they got everything. So soul isn't that difficult, you know, to find the immaterial principle. But to answer your question is, the only way to get out of the trap of thinking religion is a crutch, and therefore it's fundamentally my interior expression and a self-awareness about, you know, an ultimate meaning in life and all of that stuff, which is all Protestant, by the way. It is. Till it. Done. The ground of my being, I need it, blah, 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 is to start and say, look, that's the answer I gave you. Read the creed. I believe in God, the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth and of all things visible and invisible. That's where you have to begin. That's where the church begins. You begin there. But it's true. For reasons that are complicated historically, I'm not going to go into them. But right, the church itself has been infected with a kind of Schleiermacherian. This is a strong use of sentiment. It's not pure, mushy, Hallmark card based. Valentine sentimentalism, but you know, God is not, you know, the expression of my interior sense of dependence, which is what your interlocutor thinks it is, and you are in that unfortunate position to need it, but she's going to be fine. Well, she won't be. I don't know if she's already, you know, that anybody that's 60 isn't going to say that. But the answer is, or whether they do at 60. The answer is, you know, let's start with creation. Because that's where religion kicks in. It's because he created us, not because we think we have a need for him. And it's very bad, by the way, to present you know, the Christian religion, like, man is the problem, man or woman, like, boy or girl is the problem, God is the answer. That's Tillich, yeah? That's very bad. Because that's when you invite that. They suddenly discover they don't, you know, they don't have the problem anymore. And they don't need them, you know? So the gentleman over here, yeah?
Yeah, 1 hour a week seems very little for someone who created heaven and earth. What about other prayer and spiritual exercises?
Oh yeah, well, fine. You know, they wanted me to put at least in the title. And I said, no, let's not do that. Let's just start off with, no, fine. I mean, but anybody that goes to Mass, the problem facing the church today is people do not worship God on Sunday. That's the biggest thing. It's not abortion, it's not gay marriage, it's not, I know we're coming to that. The problem facing the church is that people don't go to church. It's documented, except, you know, so some parts of the country will.
A good Catholic, how many hours of prayer or how many minutes of prayer?
Well, that's something you have to talk about with your priest or spiritual director. I don't want to generalize about that, or not in this context. That would require another talk, too.